Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Today is very, very special for me. I have a master sommelier named Jill Zamorski joining me. She has an incredible story. She's the only person I know that has passed the master sommelier exam twice. And the reason for that is something I have never talked about nor acknowledged in this podcast. It is the Court of Master Sommeliers cheating scandal. Jill has dealt with it in a very, very first-hand manner and decided to retake the exam and passed. So we're gonna cover that. But more importantly, Jill is joining the SOM TV team with a brand new podcast that reviews wine books. I am so, so excited for this. I mean, we've needed somebody to wade through all of the literature and all of the educational content that's out there. And Jill is, well, she's the best. That's why she's doing it. That's called Reading and Drinking, and we're gonna cover that too. I wanna say something about the climate of the world at the moment too. Our company, SOM TV, and the SOM Films and Forgotten Man Films, which is the parent company, was started by myself, my wife, Christina, Jackson Myers, who shot all the films. And I just want to say that when it comes to Black Lives Matter and what is going on right now, we stand 100% behind Black Lives Matter and behind the people that are doing everything to make change. And we acknowledge that we have a platform and we are part of this change that has to happen. What I want to see for the wine business and what I want to see for the media business and film and everything is for this to not just be a moment. This needs to continue. And if it's really, really, really going to make serious, real change, it needs every platform, small ones like us and big ones like major studios and, you know, wine labels and anything where you see faces and you hear voices to acknowledge this and to work until it's done. And it might take a century. But I just want to get that off my chest that this is an incredibly important thing and we stand 100% behind it. You guys have been asking for years and we have finally opened up our merchandise store. Shop.somtv.com is a place where you can find beach towels, SOM posters, tote bags, which have coincidentally all sold out, but more are coming, are all available. So if you want to get some gear, summer gear, winter gear, prints for your office or your wine cellar, it's available now. Shop.somtv.com. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Jill. So Jill, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good. I'm not drinking wine, unfortunately. I have tea.
I'm not either. Oh my God.
It's too early. It's not too early. It's just
I just don't happen to have any in front of me.
Yeah, well, I should have done that myself. Boy, oh boy. All right, so I want to welcome you officially to the SOM TV team. You are joining us for our first of several new podcasts in the SOM TV podcast network. This is a big moment for me.
It's a big moment for me. Thank you very much.
Let's talk about this podcast, Reading and Drinking, you're going to launch. Why?
Well, you know, I've spent years, a really large portion of my adult life, studying wine and working with wine. And with the advent of the internet and websites, you know, we use electronic media for a lot of our information gathering. But I am I've always been an avid reader. And during my studies, I will say, reading for pleasure really fell off. But I try to buy and try to read, you know, every new book about wine that comes out. I enjoy different perspectives. I enjoy clearly the pursuit of learning. And one thing I've discovered as I grew in my knowledge and as I'm growing in my knowledge, just because somebody publishes a book I'm finding doesn't mean that it's good or even correct. And maybe I know it sounds terrible, but like, I don't know if I didn't notice it, you know, previously. I'm rereading some things and I'm realizing that the wine world is always changing. And so sometimes it's just simply a matter of updating. But sometimes there's just bad writing and there's, you know, facts that are incorrect. And so I think that that's important because if you are trying to push yourself and learn and become knowledgeable, and you're going to a trusted source and it turns out that it's not a good one, then you're going to do yourself a disservice. Conversely, there are some really fantastic, maybe not as sexy or popular sources for fantastic information. And, you know, I've read a few books lately that while reading it, felt, I don't think I've ever learned this much from a single book ever in my life. And so it's something that I wanted to share.
It's great. I love it. Are you going to do both nonfiction and fiction? I mean, are we talking like educational books and books that are set in the world of wine?
Yes. Yeah. It would, I mean, it might be entertaining or amusing to a very, very, very small audience if I only reviewed academic books. I don't even know if it would be entertaining to anyone other than myself. So it's going to be a mix. It'll be books that are meant to be educational. And then, you know, there are books about wine that are, you know, biographies or autobiographies or novels. And when wine plays a significant part, you know, there's more to the industry than just professionals. You know, there are lay people who enjoy wine and enjoy reading about wine and want to know more about it, who don't have any interest in, you know, taking tests for higher certifications. But those books still might be appropriate for them. So it's trying to cast a wide net.
I love it. I love it. Can you tell me, you have a couple favorite wine books?
Of course
ever?
I do. I'm not going to tell you, though. That's the point of the podcast.
Okay.
You're going to have to subscribe.
Okay, people will have
to subscribe.
Okay, fine. I love it. All right, you have an insanely, I mean, at least in my opinion, moniker, an insanely interesting moniker. Are you the only person that has passed the Master Sommelier exam twice?
No. I could be wrong, but I think that there's 9 people, I think, who have.
And all of these people were involved in the quote-unquote scandal?
Yeah, what happened in 2018 is pretty unprecedented. And so no one has ever had their credentials revoked before. And so no one was ever put in this position where they would have to test to regain their title again. So that's just never happened before. So the only people it could have happened to were the people that I passed with in 2018.
Wow. I mean, I think for people who don't understand what happened, how do you? Can I just take 1 second and share my thoughts on
sure.
this scandal? It's just a quick thing, because the one problem about even talking about this is that there's no, I don't know that there's any winners here. Everybody sort of loses in this, right?
Yeah, everybody does.
I mean, the court loses, and I have people who are immensely good friends of mine within the organization. Obviously, my first film centered around that entire organization, so I can't seem to shake my involvement. I'm sure they can't shake their involvement with me. But the court is made up, just like any body, of lots of different kinds of people. But with the organization, it's kind of a, they didn't win, the candidates didn't win. Can you set up what happened with this scandal? And or whatever it's going to be called. I mean, what happened, Jill?
Well, I mean, it is scandalous what happened. And it's so, I've had a little over a year to almost 2 years to reflect on it. And I still am just kind of gobsmacked about just the insanity of the whole situation. So a few years ago, starting in 2014, I believe, for the Master Sommelier exam, the theory portion was separated from the other two portions, the practical and the tasting. And so by the time you get to, you have to pass the theory exam, rather, before you are able to then take the practical, the service exam, or the blind tasting exam. So in 2018, that exam was held in St. Louis, Missouri. Nothing against St. Louis, but I feel like I've just gone there for a long time to taste wine, and I don't want to go back. But in 2018, I, along with, I don't know how many, 50, 60 other people were there. At that point, I only had the tasting exam left. So I had previously passed theory and service and took the test for the first time in 5 attempts. Felt pretty good.
So this was your sixth time taking the master exam?
It was my fifth. So
fifth.
In 2018,
okay.
Yeah, you have to pass all three parts in 3 years. If you don't do that successfully, you reset, you start over. So that happened to me in 2016. I retook theory in 2017, passed it. Then was able to take service and tasting later in 2017, passed service, didn't pass tasting, came back in 2018 just to take tasting. And I passed it. And it was, I mean, I'm not trying to exaggerate, but it was one of the most special things in my entire life. It was, you know, a large number, record-setting number of people passed, which was exciting because a lot of people that I've gotten to know through the process were there and we passed together, which is incredibly special. And I received my feedback from, you know, someone who had mentored me and been a friend to me. And it was, you know, we do a lot of visualizing as part of, you know, I'm not the only one, but a lot of people visualize stuff. And you visualize, you know, calling the wines correctly. You visualize what it's going to be like. And it was just how I pictured it. It was really, really special. And It's very surreal because I spent 12 years from the time I took my introductory exam to the time I passed. So it's a big chunk of my adult life. And then, you know, you're celebrated. I came back to Chicago and there were, you know, my work colleagues were ecstatic and we had several internal celebrations and external celebrations. And it was wonderful. Plus a tremendous sense of relief because putting yourself through the rigors that are required to study for this exam, it takes a toll mentally and physically and emotionally. And so I felt like a huge weight was lifted that I had accomplished this thing that I had been working for so long. And that feeling lasted for about 5 weeks. So I got a telephone call from a member of the board of directors. And to be fully honest, I thought that they were calling to ask me to come teach a class because I should say that one of the biggest, kind of most exciting things when you pass the exam, at least for me, is that what you then can do is pay it forward. You know, you spend all this time acquiring knowledge, and then you share it, you teach, and you pass it forward. And so I was scheduled to teach several different exams, and I was super excited about it because that's the next step. And that phone call was not about that at all. And I was told that there had been a problem with the test, that candidates that had been compromised, that candidates had been given information, and that the exam was going to be invalidated. And I still get a little nauseous when I think about it, because my first response was to throw up, and then to kind of, I was shaking. It was just really hard to believe.
Jill, how do you compare the emotion you felt when you finally passed with the emotion you felt from a level standpoint? I know it's the opposite direction, but from a standpint of the energy of emotion,
when you
found out
it
was taken away.
I mean, sucked all the air out of the room. I was shaky. It was one of the worst feelings I could, short of like personal tragedy and something happening to friends or family. It was one of the worst things I could imagine because it's kind of your greatest fear. And I say this because when you spend so long, some people longer than others, working towards a goal and you achieve it, it's hard. You don't just immediately accept it and realize, like, this is my new reality. It takes a little bit of time for it to sink in that, you know, this is a thing now. And actually, at the exam, after we got our results, I was talking to a master sommelier who had passed the year before, and it had been in St. Louis the year before, and they were saying that it was a little bit trippy to be back there because it was only a year later, and they still had, you know, flashes to, like, you know, I have nightmares or feel like any day now someone could tell me I've been punked and this is a big old joke and it's not actually a thing. And then that was happening. And I was like, Oh God, this is actually happening. So it was awful.
So press, I mean, I know that there were articles that came out that talked about you and there were, I mean, this is not something that, I can truly understand what you've gone through because I have never achieved something of that, you know, that level. You know, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to even position the question I'm at, but when it happened, and obviously there could be an entire five more podcasts related to the fact of like how it happened and what the circumstances are. But, you know, from your perspective, I don't know, does a lot of that even matter? Is the most important thing just that? I guess I should flat out ask you, did you cheat, Jill?
No, I didn't. Unequivocally, not only did I not cheat, I have adamantly defended myself and many of my other friends and colleagues to the point that I offered to take a lie detector test. I offered up my computers, my cell phone, my iPad for forensic analysis. Like, I got nothing to hide. I worked my ass off and I passed and I didn't cheat and other people did.
But there was a record number of people who passed. I mean, that's...
Yeah, and, you know, a lot was made about that. But the way the exam is structured, like I was saying, you know, there were friends that I've known for years, and we've been testing together for years, and everyone at the tasting or service exam has already gotten one-third of the way through the exam. So not to say that if you just keep trying and keep trying, everyone will eventually pass. That's not the case. But there were a lot of people at that exam who had... you know, at a very high level, obviously it's the Master Sommelier exam, who had passed one or two parts already, who have maybe taken the exam several times before. And it was just sort of the flood, not that the floodgates opened, but it's not surprising that 4 years after they changed the structure of the exam, there were just a lot of people who were on the cusp and got through. To me, that's not surprising.
Right. And it's,
but a lot of people made something about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, from that perspective is really important because I think even if you look at prior years, you know, of which I followed the MS exam, God, was it almost 4 years, I believe I was involved with this exam just to make my first movie. And I saw a similar thing. When I filmed Ian at Meadowood in Napa, there was one person who passed. And then the following year, there were more. And then, you know, there were a bunch of people who passed when the people who passed in Psalm 1 did. And it was quite a few more, and it was the same answer. The reason that happened was because of the buildup. You know, there was just people that sort of got into a queue of passing different parts and what have you. And I think it's really important you bring this up because there was such a to-do about the fact that there were so many people. I also have to say, full disclosure, I mean, the person who was involved with, is it alleged at this point or did leak?
I mean, it's...
I don't want to throw stones I'm not allowed to throw. There's never been a statement.
Well, yeah, right? I mean, there's never been like a trial to my knowledge, so no one's been convicted of a crime. Not that that's, I don't know if you could, I don't know how you would, I don't know. I guess technically you should say alleged, but I think it's pretty common knowledge who was behind it.
Well, I mean, one of those people was in my first film. I mean, I can say that.
Yeah.
I don't want to, or the person, I don't want to throw stones that have not been, you know, I guess... I don't know. I'm not a member of the court. And like I said, I deeply love and respect a lot of people who are. So I want to be respectful in the way I talk about this. But, you know, I also love a lot of people who had themselves sort of dragged emotionally through. I mean, Jane Lopes is a good friend, and I'll call her out by name because I know she was very vocal in what this did to her emotionally. And, you know, I mean, there was a lot of press about her in Australia passing the exam. And I, you know, my heart absolutely sunk when this happened because it was like the last thing this world needed. It seemed like there was a moment when the court, which again, another entire topic, which is a lot of, you know, older white guys, was starting to look like it was, you know, new people were coming in. It was going to be a very, it was changing in a quicker way than I think people expected. And then this happened. And it was really It was a shot to us on the outside. So for you on the inside, I couldn't possibly imagine. But a lot of people decided not to retake it. A lot of people said, you know, proverbially, they said, fuck you, we're out, right? I mean, there was no...
Oh, yeah, and I felt that way for a while. You know, one thing...
So the listeners know, the people, the entire exam was just washed away. Right? It didn't happen? Is that how it was approached?
Yeah, it was invalidated. So anyone who took the tasting exam, I'm pretty sure I got this right, anyone who was taking the tasting exam in St. Louis in 2018, because there were people who passed the tasting exam who did not pass the whole Master Sommelier exam at that point. So we, this unfortunate group of people who passed the exam based on tasting, we had our credentials stripped. But there are other people who, while they didn't pass the Master Sommelier exam in totality, they picked up tasting, and that was eradicated for them. So they just erased the results, quote-unquote erased, because you can't, you know, go back and erase time. But they just pretended, you know, they said, this didn't happen. We're going to just mark this one off the books.
Right. And so a lot of people said they offered the chance to then retake it for everybody because they couldn't prove who cheated or
well,
it would be messy to try
prove,
to figure it out.
Didn't
or,
try. I don't know if it'd be that messy. I have strong opinions on that. But yes, everyone was given the opportunity to take the exam again.
Yeah. And let me ask you just something else. Are you nervous to talk about this at all? I mean, it's not like the court's like the mafia or anything, but I mean, are you
no,
concerned at all? Or
no, because I'm not. And one thing I've tried, it's a difficult needle to thread, but one thing I've said previously, rather, and I maintain, is that one, I have nothing to hide. And two, this is not how I wanted this to be. This is not how my story in my mind was supposed to go. No one in their right mind. I mean, I think what you want about having passed this exam twice. If I had to go back, I would not choose this path. No one wanted to be part of this situation. And so it was made part of my story by the actions of other people. So I take complete ownership of that. And it's my story now, and I'll talk about it to whoever wants to talk about it. And that could be a sommelier that I, you know, would work with through the course of my job, or it could be a random reporter. It could be you. It could be anyone. And it's my story. It's part of my story. And so I'm not afraid of that. And, you know, one of the biggest things I think for me with blind tasting, or with, I think with a lot of people with the Master Sommelier exam, is you really have to contend with confidence. You have to believe in yourself. And I will say that I have an extra boost of confidence having passed it twice, that I'm like, I don't fear that. I just think it shouldn't have had to take that step. So no, I'm not. And I also try to be I have some strong opinions, and I'll watch what I say. And
this is also why you're going to be fantastic on your new podcast. Strong opinions are good.
But I mean, we can disagree with people and not be, you know, disagreeable. I'm not sure who said that. I have some strong comments and strong opinions on how things went down.
I'm sure.
But
you
I
do.
Also, you know, I was talking to my father about this and whether I was deciding to go back and take the exam again, and then after passing, whether I wanted to even be involved in this organization. And he said, you know, gosh, Jill, it would be a real shame if you went through all of this and you just kept your knowledge to yourself. You know, you want to pay it forward, share it. And I like to do that through teaching. And so I'm still part of this organization because it provides me an opportunity to reach sommeliers and teach and mentor. And that's something that's been really important to me and part of my career trajectory. That doesn't mean I agree with everything that the court has and is doing.
Well, I also think, too, I mean, any organization, if you completely and totally agreed with everything, you know, you probably belong to a cult. So it's a good thing that you feel that way, I think. And also, I know a lot of prominent members of the court, good friends of mine and others, you know, stood with you guys and fought hard. And it's not like it was, you know, it wasn't. You know, this isn't a name-naming podcast, but it wasn't, you know, it created quite a divide from what I could see.
Sure it did. But, you know, what those folks did is so meaningful to me, because I realized that people who I don't really have necessarily a direct, you know, personal or professional connection with were willing to speak truth to power and fight for what they felt was right on behalf of people that, in my case, they didn't really have a connection to. And so that they were willing to do that kind of empowered me and gave me the, you know, a little bit of the strength that I was needing to go back to take the test again. I will appreciate them forever.
Right. No, and all these people you're naming are very, very wonderful humans. I think I want to kind of talk about, why did you decide to retake it? Because I've spoken privately with a lot of people. When this happened, Jill, I got to tell you, this is not like a woe is me, and I'm not trying to make this story about me at all. In fact, I tried very hard to stay out of this, and I'm kind of wondering why I'm even having this conversation. I'll regret it. But when it happened, because the court didn't really issue a lot of statements. They didn't talk to people. They didn't talk to the press. And so naturally, a lot of the press turned their eyes to me, and they said— And they said, talk to us about the court. And I realized the position that I was inadvertently in was somebody who was a sort of insider without, you know, who could talk. And I basically, my response to every time and it was a lot of inquiries. A lot of people wanted to know what I thought about this. And my first response was, why? You know, why me? Like, what, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And then, I made Sam. Sam was a lot of the general public's entrance into knowing that the court exists. And so it kind of makes sense in that regard. But I spoke to so many people on the inside when it happened, and they said, Jason, you should make something about this. And it was like the thought of it kind of turned my stomach. Because again, it goes back to there's no winners here. You know, no matter what, you're villainizing people. That is not, it's not like it's one person per se that it may be that did something wrong, but there's dominoes, and it's nuanced and it's complicated. And so I didn't want to do anything about it, but I did speak to a lot of people who reached out to me, and their side of why they didn't want to take the exam again it made a lot of sense. And in a lot of cases, they were afraid that it would portray them as I cheated, so I'm not going to retake it. And I think that it's such an unfortunate thing that some of these people were put in this position.
Oh, it's horrible.
Why? Go ahead.
No, I said, you know, when people, you know, everyone responded differently to the situation. Some people were super vocal. Some people were really quiet. Some people just seemed to, I don't know, I mean, I'm not inside anyone else's head, but some people seem to just, if not accept, but, you know, just kind of make the best of it and say, well, I'm just going to go back and take the test again. And some people are like, heck no, I'm not going to go back and do that again. And I always said, you know, everyone's allowed to feel however they want. I don't agree with how some of the people responded, but everyone's allowed, it's a very personal thing for all of us. And so everyone's allowed to feel however they feel.
Can I?
Some of my very, yeah.
I gotta ask you, since we have a platform, there's a lot of listeners to this podcast. You don't have to name any names, but I assume you know or feel you know who cheated, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. What would you say to them right now? If they're listening to this podcast, what would you say to the people who cheated?
Oh, God. You might have to bleep me on this one.
Go for it.
Fuck you. it was such a cowardly and such a selfish thing that these people did. Two people who passed the exam got the information. So I don't know how you reconcile that. Like, you know, one person stayed quiet. I don't know if I can name names. They were, it's not a secret, but you tell me, you can bleep them out. But, you know, one person professed their, like, woe is me, I was a victim. That's bullshit. You weren't a victim. And so two people passed, one person didn't. And that person was one of my best friends. And she admitted to me over the phone that she got the email. And the thing is, everybody had the opportunity to do the right thing, and none of them took it. To the point that told me in a phone conversation, Jill, I should have told you, you would have done the right thing. And I said, you're goddamn right I would have. I would have run down the hall with my hair on fire screaming. Like, if any of those people had just had enough courage and fortitude and, you know, conviction of courage and integrity just to speak up. But they were cowardly and they were a disgrace. And the worst part is, you know, it was like a boulder rolling downhill, or a snowball rolling downhill, I should say. Like, it just kept getting worse. Like, I thought the day I got the news was bad and it was like shockwaves. And then my phone started exploding with texts and statements came out, but it kept getting bigger. You know, like, my local newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, had reached out because two of us in Chicago had passed the exam.
Your local newspaper? One of the biggest newspapers in the country. Okay, keep going.
But they never actually wrote an article about us passing the exam. But you know that reporter was right after us the minute this news broke. And he wanted, and I was like, I'm not talking to you. Like, are you kidding me? I just ignored his calls. And to this day, it's great. I passed the test twice. But if you Google my name, you're still find articles where my name is linked to a cheating scandal. So to the people that did this, oh, man, there's a special place reserved for people who will betray their friends and their colleagues with that level of, you know, cowardice and just overall shittiness. I don't really have a better word for it. It's not terribly poetic, but they're bad.
I don't know.
And I feel real bad because I feel like I must have really misjudged, you know, friends and acquaintances.
But well, what do they say? You don't really know somebody's true character until you squeeze them, you know?
Right? And you know, integrity is how you act when no one's looking. And it's defined right there.
Yeah, well, I think this kind of stuff is important for people to know. And it's...
Yeah.
Okay, so you went on. Others decided, screw this. I don't want to be associated with the organization. And that's, you know, I don't know. I was never put in a position like this. So I can't say, first of all, you know, how I would have reacted to, do I take it again? Do I not? You know, so that's why I'm here, to hear your opinion. I mean, this is such a tough position to be put in. Why did you retake the test?
So there's a step in there that we kind of don't talk about. And we were given, everyone whose exam was invalidated, was given the opportunity for a retest in either, I believe, so we got the news in October after passing in September. And then the opportunity for a retest was either in December or I think in April of the following year. And some people didn't go back. And I selected, and I have very few regrets in my life, but I, to this day, and I probably will always regret taking that retest in December, because so much of your approach to this exam is mental. And if you're in a bad place mentally, full of anger and grief and sorrow and bitterness and rage, you got no business putting yourself through one of the more mentally challenging things you can do. And I was just, I mean, that fourth quarter of 2018 is kind of a blur, because it was just, I mean, there was a lot of tequila, but I was just in a bad place, you know? And I and a few other people went, we took the exam again, and I walked into the room angry. And not surprisingly, I didn't pass. And so I didn't want to talk to anyone. It was months where people would give me a wide berth because I was visibly, you know, upset by this. And so not passing that retest, my situation was a little bit different, I think, than some other people's. And like I said, everyone responds to this in their own way. So you have 3 years to pass all three parts. When I passed in 2018, I still had time on the clock. It was my second attempt of 3 years. The retest in December or April didn't count against attempts. It was just like a redo. So retaking and not passing in December of 2018 didn't do anything. I still had another attempt, quote unquote, on my personal clock before I would be forced to retest. Plus, I was also preparing for another, I'm an incredibly tortured person, I suppose, but I was preparing for another wine test that would involve blind tasting through another organization, through the WSET. And I was going to need to be blind tasting, even though it's a different format and different examining body anyway. And so for months, I was like, screw it. You know, F this, I'm not going to go back. And then I was like, from a pragmatic standpoint, I was like, well, it's not a reset year. And I am going to be in the, you know, practice of tasting wine. And so it was a pretty last minute decision. I mean, you have to tell them if you're going to come or not. And I did. But I kept it real quiet. It was, and humiliation is the wrong word because I didn't do anything wrong that I should have felt embarrassed or humiliated about. But I think it's the, you know, seeing your name splashed across like in association with the scandal when you did nothing wrong. Like I just kept it really quiet because everything had been super public and I just didn't think I could take more of that. So I think like I had to tell my boss because I was going to have to leave work early, drive to St. Louis, take the test and then come right back. And she said, that's cool. But none of my colleagues knew. I had two good friends in Chicago who were pouring wines for me to taste. So there are maybe like half a dozen people who knew. I didn't tell my parents. I just figured if I go down there and I take it, then come what may. And if I pass, great. It won't actually change anything because it'll just be reconfirming what had happened months prior. And if I don't pass, then at least it won't be as public as December was. So I decided to go after it again.
Yeah. Like I have had the privilege and also the stress of being around a lot of your kind. And I will say there is a certain, I'll call it like a winning quality where it's like you must finish, you must see it through attitude. And so I'm not surprised that you did it, but what was your goal if you were going to pass to come in and what were you trying to accomplish? Because it had to be deeper than just, oh, I want to teach more. I want, you know, maybe a higher position. And you know, so what did you mean to do by taking the exam again and passing?
Well, I think it's cumulative of all those things. It's the situation for me was maybe less of, there's always pressure, but like having reset before, when it's a pass or reset situation, the pressure is even more intense. And not everybody who passes this exam has been through a reset. I don't recommend it. It sucks. But I wasn't facing that pressure. Like I said, I was studying for another exam. I kept it pretty quiet. So there were like a few factors that made it less, you know, painful in some ways. And then I think also I did feel a little bit of like wanting to not clear my name because it, you know, but sort of clear my name and like, hey, look, because I don't like saying that because it, to me, you could read that someone who didn't take the test again, like it implies guilt. That's not the case. I just, for me, I was like, I want to be recognized for what I achieve. And I also feel, and I've said this a bunch, very strongly, and I've been very open about my disagreements with how this was handled by the Court of Master Sommeliers, and I think that needs to change. And you can't, not to say you can't change an organization from the outside, but maybe you will have more success changing that organization from the inside. I sort of felt like if I didn't go back and I continued to criticize, I felt like maybe I'd be like outside a, you know, a sliding glass door, pounding my fists on it, you know, like yelling. But if I passed again and was on the inside, you know, I can use, you know, put my voice and my vote to good work. So that was a big part of it.
It's very clear. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, there is definitely something that I think members of the court, I suppose, open themselves up to having these opinions out there, you know, if they're going to let people retest. I mean, you know, it's just sort of a way it is, you know? I mean, do you think, can this happen again?
I sure as heck hope not. I mean, the way it happened, and I've said this before, it was like a Scooby-Doo caper. It was so low-tech. An email? Seriously? Like an email? Like, the court needs to be more proactive, and they've shared, you know, steps they've taken to make it more secure. I've suggested some, and I think that there's a big chasm between my perception. Now, having just recently passed, I have not examined at a higher level exam, so I'm not privy to, you know, some of the what has to go on to make the test secure. But from what I've been told and from what I've asked and had answered, I still think that there's a lot of work to be done because.
Well, in fairness, though, I suppose just to play devil's advocate, I'm sure you can admit they had a pretty serious challenge ahead of them to figure out what do we do here, you know. And it was again,
there must have been a damned if you don't
situation. I mean, I don't even think there would be winners depending on any decision they made. You know,
I disagree with that. Well, there's no winners, but I think it. I'm sure it's a daunting decision, but I just disagree with the fundamental idea that the credential is more important than the people who make it up, because without the people in the organization, it's worthless. And I think the decision, I'm not saying it was made flippantly. It seemed to be made very quickly based on the timeline of this whole thing. But it's incongruous with how higher education bodies or our justice system would ever handle something like this. That it's just, there's an assumption of guilt, therefore invalidation, rather than an investigation. And look, if there's nothing to prove that someone did anything wrong, they earned that title. No one's disputing that the people who passed the exam. Now, some of them got some inside knowledge, but for the people who didn't get that information, they passed the exam. So, you know, just going back and invalidating the exam doesn't diminish their accomplishments. They did it. And I still think, and I'll say this forever, is that it's never too late to do the right thing. And if somebody were to say tomorrow, you know what? After a year of intense investigation, and we've determined that these people did nothing wrong, and their status is reinstated, you know, forthwith, the court's stronger for it. You know, like the court has a little bit of an image problem lately for a lot of reasons, and
that's a different podcast. I feel like
it's a whole other podcast, but
one I probably shouldn't host.
But and people can disagree with me, but I think that would actually display the level of care and humanity that we hope an organization that is comprised of humans and adjudicates humans in a hospitality environment, you know, I think it would reflect positively.
Well, two statements I would say. Any organization, it doesn't matter. It could be European, Asian, American, any high standard organization, whether it's West Point or, you know, I mean, geez, I mean, even some of like the most prestigious colleges in history, you're going to have something like this happen. I mean, there's admission scandals happening right now at USC and all of this stuff with celebrities buying their way in. There's West Point had an enormous scandal where people fabricated tests and were cheating. And so it's going to happen. I think it's not a, is that going to happen? It's a, how do you deal with it when it does? And the question I have for you is the court at that level? I mean, do you think there should have been like criminal charges for this? Is that really what you think?
I don't know what the crime would be, but I'm not a lawyer. I used to want to be one. But like I graduated from the University of Virginia, and they have a pretty famous honor code. And I'm not the only UVA alum who's a master sommelier, but like on every exam or test that you take at the university, you sign the honor pledge. And it's a single, well, I think actually they've modified it, but for a long time it was a single sanction system that if you were, you know, suspected of lying, cheating, or stealing, like there's basically, you know, you can get represented by a law student, but there's an honor procedure and you are either exonerated or found guilty and expelled. And even that, but they do an investigation. And so,
but you don't think the court, you don't think the court did an investigation? I mean, they had to do something.
Jason, nobody ever asked me one single question. Like you asked me on this podcast, Jill, did you cheat? No, I didn't. No one from the court even asked me that. I mean, you think they could have like asked a whole lot more questions. Did you see anything? Did you hear anything? Did you witness anything that seemed a little bit off? Not a single question.
Wow.
So if I just, that's that gives me my skepticism about the vigor of the investigation.
Well, I would assume if they have anything that even touches the severity of this again, it'll be handled in a much different... Well, you'll probably be president of the court at that point, so people will be... I have a feeling you'll bring back the guillotine.
Oh, no.
All right, good. That's probably a good policy. Don't chop heads off.
Yeah, no.
But, okay, so what have we learned, and where do we go, and how do we move forward? I know you mentioned the court's current image problem, which, oh, boy. But where do we go from the scandal thing? Because maybe in a way, this started a domino effect of change that is hopefully going to continue flying. And it's not just the court. Look, every organization, every group of people, everybody is having their eyes opened in a big way right now to change that needs to be made, or at least how do we make change? You know, so what have we learned?
Well, I think a few things. One, I think there's just a lot of naivete that this is a niche organization, and, you know, there are a lot of privileges enjoyed by being a member of it, by being a master sommelier. It's a really small group of people worldwide. And I think that times have changed rapidly in the 4 decades since the inception of this organization. And I don't think the organization's kept up with those times very well. I think it needs to be way more proactive because it seems to be reactive. You know, there should have been anticipation that something like this could have happened, and there should have been fail-safes in place, you know, from it. And I think that it doesn't take a terrible amount of, you know, creativity to think of some examples of how things could be more secure. And I think transparency is really important. You know, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to hide. And I understand that there's sometimes cases for discretion. But one of the things I encountered, and I was very measured, and I still am to some degree, you know, I'll answer any question anyone asks me, but I don't... And I didn't want my terrible experience to adversely affect someone who is still pursuing court certifications experience. It's their experience, and hopefully what happened to me will and everyone else will not happen to them. But one thing I felt is that people feel uncomfortable criticizing the organization when they are still pursuing certification through the organization. And
out of a fear that that'll affect their ability to get in? Yeah.
Because... Yeah, and it could be whether it's criticizing how this was handled or security, or, you know, if somebody said or did something that made them feel uncomfortable. You know, people are reticent to speak out against the organization because they still want to be part of it, because it is, you know, it's an interesting and novel credential.
But this is also this isn't unique to the court. This would be any organization that holds a high standard or holds high, you know, people respect, and so
sure.
But anyways,
I think being more proactive and also being more transparent are two important things in the future of the court for things I think that need to happen.
Well, I know a lot of people who are wonderful, truly, truly, insanely selfless, generous people. We work with a lot of them on SOM TV. I mean, I'll name names in that regard. I mean, like Bobby Stuckey and Sabato Sagaria and Emily Wines. And, you know, these are people who they throw themselves out in front of education and issues and try to make change from within. And I mean, there are so many more that I didn't just name that are truly wonderful people. So
There's a lot of really, really, really good people in this organization. I don't know them all. There might be great people who I've never met before. I mean, it's not that big of an organization, but I've not been a part of it for very long. And if, you know, you don't necessarily cross everyone's paths through your journey. And so, you know, my frustrations and my disagreements with how things were handled doesn't mean that I don't have friends or close relationships with people in this organization. And I think it's important to be able to, you know, recognize that some of those people don't agree with how I feel or things I might say, but we're still, you know, we're still friends or we're still colleagues or we're still, you know, able to work together or teach together. And That's important with regard to this cheating scandal. You know, there's obviously, you know, there are many layers to these conversations, but there's a lot of really good people in this organization. And I think there's, people who also want change, and not everybody is outspoken about it. And that's fine, too. Not everybody has the vehicle or the platform to do that.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. Yeah, and it's easy, especially for somebody like me to sit here and, you know, lob comments from a microphone. Sure. So, I mean, there's nuance to this, and you're absolutely right.
Yeah, there is.
It has to be approached properly. But the reason I wanted you to tell this story was that you are, well, you parachuted in, you know, and fought on the front lines yourself. So it's an interesting thing. Plus, with you joining this team, I think people can get a sense of your integrity and your personality. And they damn well better sign up for your podcast if you speak like
Hell
this.
Oh, yeah.
it's a good thing. I'm honored to have you part of this team, Jill. I'm honored
to be part of it.
Oh, it's so fun. So I guess my last question, and this is it, because I always like to ask what people, what they're drinking now. We're in COVID times. Money's tight. Mm. What are you drinking?
Well, there's no way to say this that doesn't sound a little bit like, oh, poor me. But a lot of people who do work in the beverage industry happen to have a lot of wine at home. And so I am not going to any sort of alcohol shortages. You know, my normal job.
I am. I have children and, you know.
Oh, see.
I don't give the children the alcohol, but they force me to drink more, so.
You know, one of the biggest changes that's been interesting is the job that I've had for the past 4 years, I'm furloughed from it, but I've been working in the champagne business, you know, for the past 4 years minus the past couple months. And so as part of, you know, one of the benefits of that vocation is I got to taste a lot of really, really nice champagne. And so it was probably the thing that I drank more often than anything else, just as a virtue of what I was working with, what I was around, what I had open. And not that I don't have plenty of champagne at home, but I haven't really been drinking that much champagne, which is crazy. I like to mix it up. I'm not really much of a beer drinker. When the weather's nice, I make gin and tonics more often than not.
Oh, I love gin and tonics. It's a serious problem for me, gin and tonics.
No. I've actually been going through, I have, you know, like house wine in my cellar, or buy a couple of cases of something where, you know, not too expensive, that I'll just keep in the fridge. And I'm still actually working through 3 cases of rosé that I bought last summer. Still tastes great. I know that rosé is usually more often than not you consume it in its youth, but
no way. I did an entire podcast with Laura Mann, or Laura Fioravanti, now she's married, about aged rosé. I mean, it's one of my favorite things in the world.
There's
Domaine Tempié and
This is not that. This is like a Beaujolais rosé. This is like stuff on clothes. Yeah, this is not anything fancy. So I still have some of that from my house rosé. And then one of the things I did when I was preparing for tasting is I built up a tasting cellar. And so I have Coravin, and I would spend my money on trying to get really high quality examples of wines. I made for myself kind of a spreadsheet of what I considered to be testable wines. I mean, the court does not provide that, but you can, with any reasonable amount of, you know, familiarity with this industry, recognize that, you know what, Pinot Noir, it's pretty fair game for a blind tasting. Where is it fair game from? Well, Oregon, California, France, New Zealand. And so I made a list for myself, and I would buy examples of wines that reflected, you know.
And so you're right now you're just drinking your cellar of what you had from all that.
Yeah, not because I've accessed these wines from Coravin. And so, you know, I would pull samples from them and taste. And then obviously if it got down to about a third of the bottle, I would just pull the cork and drink it because it's a waste of gas. But at the same point, you know, where we've been in quarantine, I'm not pouring blind tasting, you know, I'm not having anyone come over to my house, I'm not going anywhere to anyone's restaurant to pour them, you know, flights for blinding, because there's no test to be given right now. So Coravin's a great preservation tool, but it's not infinite. And so I've just been drinking my cellar. So I had some Alsatian Riesling last night, and the night before that I had some Beaujolais and not the rosé, but some Rouge. So I've just been, I just go downstairs and I look, you know, and I just pull a few things here and there.
Love it. Love it. This is so good. Well, I cannot wait for your podcast. I am literally dying. And if offline you want any suggestions on things, I would beg you to review.
Oh, always. I'll always take suggestions because it just means more fun stuff for me to read.
Review the Sideways book, please. Okay, anyways, we will talk quite a bit. I can't wait for your podcast. Everybody who is listening, please, please go to, we need to get you to subscribe to Jill's podcast, Reading and Drinking. It'll be available everywhere you get your podcasts. And it's one of many original shows launching on the SOMTV podcast network. Our merchandising store is open now, so you know you needed a SOM beach towel. Go and get that there. And we will talk to you very soon. Our episodes are starting back up, so thanks for your patience with that, and happy drinking, everybody.